Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Jonathan Bernstein. Bernstein is a senior research editor and writer at Rolling Stone, and author of What Do You Do When You're Lonesome?, the authorized biography of Justin Townes Earl, published by DeCapo. On this episode, we discuss the origins of the book, Earl's relationship with his hometown of Nashville, Tennessee, as well as his dedication to the craft of songwriting. That's Jonathan Bernstein discussing Justin Townes Earl on Into Music, coming up now. I kind of want to start with the obvious question, which was, where did this kind of start for you, the whole book project?
I was a huge fan of Justin's. My kind of relationship to him, you know, to his music goes all the way back to 2009 when I first saw him play right after Midnight at the Movies came out at a little club in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was in college, and it blew my mind, opened me up to a whole, really his whole generation of musicians coming out of Nashville and making Americana his age. So that was really, I was a huge fan from that very day. And I covered Justin's music, you know, when I started working as a music journalist in the 2010s, and I got to interview him once and review a few of his records, and was just a huge kind of, I was a huge fan of Justin's and viewed him as, you know, one of those career artists that I would just be kind of checking in on every time he ever released music, you know? And I think it was for a number of those reasons, I think that maybe that personal connection I had to him going all the way back to college, that I found myself so unexpectedly affected by his death in 2020. And it's really kind of, it was the months after his death where really the seeds of this book started. I spent the fall of 2020 kind of working on a story for Rolling Stone about Justin, and kind of started to talk to people in his family and to his bandmates, and started to try to get a little bit of a better sense of him. And that story just kind of left me with an appetite to keep searching, unlike any piece that I'd ever written before. I kind of, by the time I ended the piece, I felt like I knew less about him than when I started, and I had, you know, interviewed 30 people, and his life just, this seemed like there was so much more to his life and so much more to his humanity that people even knew, and that I was just, I couldn't stop thinking about his music and him and his story. And that's really kind of where the idea for this book started.
Wow. So in doing stories and so forth, you were starting to connect with people. So it wasn't like this thing where you didn't have any connection and you had to just start from scratch.
The fact that I had written this story about Justin, and it was for me, it was one of the longer stories I'd ever written. It was like, you know, 5,000 words or a couple pages in a magazine. I'd met, 30 or so of his kind of close collaborators and loved ones doing that piece. So that was really sort of, as I started to expand, you know, try to turn that 30 into 300, right? And really just talk to anyone that I could. It was helpful to show that story to people and let them know, like, hey, this is kind of broadly how I see Justin's life story. And, you know, I'm just trying to learn more. I know I don't know everything. And those initial folks that I did speak to in that story, people in Justin's teenage band, the Swindlers, people who had sort of been his side musicians throughout his career, also his contemporaries, people like Jessica Lee Mayfield, and then, of course, his widow and one of his ex-girlfriends. Those were some of the kind of like original, really important sources that started connecting me to other people and just opening up his world to all in all sorts of directions. And that was a really fun process for me to just track down, you know, anyone from his past that had never spoken to a journalist about him before.
Can we talk a little bit about the geography of Justin's life? Because so much of it is in a pretty small segment of Nashville. Even though he moves away, it's really, it kind of starts and ends a very, very small sphere.
Definitely. Justin, you know, it almost might be a cliche for a biographer or a writer to say this, but like as I continued to learn more about Justin's life and started to try to tell his story, the city of Nashville, and to your point, really like a couple square miles within that city, really started to feel like, if not the main character, one of the sort of primary kind of like driving forces and shapes and influences on Justin's life. I mean, he was born and raised Nashvillean. He was so proud of it. He also had a strong love-hate relationship with where he was from. And he loved, like so many folks who love where they're from, that you kind of love to hate where you're from as well, as a way of showing that love. And Justin loved to complain about Nashville, especially as the city changed and all of these things. But what I started to find as Justin sort of moved to New York, or he moved to Portland, or he moved to Chicago, he would always find his way back. And he would usually, those times away oftentimes really led to really interesting kind of perspective on his hometown. A lot of Justin's greatest songs, either musically or lyrically, kind of that are Nashville influenced and inspired, came when he was, away. When he was on the West Coast, he finally finished this song called Kids in the Street, which is this like almost memoiristic account of his childhood in Hillsborough Village in Nashville that he had started as a young man. But I found it very interesting that he kind of needed to move 2,000 miles away in order to actually write about it. He was truly born and raised in Nashville, and as you hinted at, he died about a little more than a mile away from the hospital in which he was born. So his story really begins and ends very much in a little part of Nashville that is largely kind of like south of downtown, and now it's very fancy, but it was a kind of up and coming middle class neighborhood when Justin grew up there in the 80s and 90s.
I mean, that part of it is so interesting to me because Nashville's a big enough town where he could have moved to other neighborhoods, and for a neighborhood that probably had a lot of painful associations, other people might have, and he just keeps going back.
He does. And, Justin, as far as I know, really, at least as an adult, the only time, I mean, he briefly lives downtown in his 30s. Which is a little bit of a departure for him. And he lives for about a year in East Nashville, which is, of course, what's interesting is Justin, he ended up becoming so associated with this kind of like this generation of younger Americana rootsy artists, kind of becomes associated with the neighborhood East Nashville in the late 2000s and 2010s. But Justin really hardly ever lived there. He, to your point, really would always come back to like the it's very like Bruce Springsteen's My Father's House, and the scene in the new movie about Bruce Deliver Me from Nowhere, where he's just this period in Bruce's life where he's just driving around the literal streets as that he grew up in, and driving past his childhood home and like working through the stuff. It's kind of what Justin, I think, consciously or not, was doing in some ways. I mean, in the last years of his life, I was very struck by some of the stories that folks, Justin had moved away to the West Coast with his wife and his young child in his adulthood, but the last year of his life, basically, he spent back in Nashville. And I spoke to some people, the musician Brady Blade, a great drummer and session musician. He told me the story about how, a little bit less than a year before Justin died, Brady was walking down the street. And he just comes across Justin standing outside the MAPCO gas station that was just like a block away from his childhood apartment with his mom. Just, he's just kind of loitering out there, smoking a cigarette, just like on an evening stroll. And there was something very poetic and, to me, very kind of moving, heartbreaking, and telling about these images of just people literally running into Justin on the literal three, four, five, six blocks of his childhood, just kind of wandering around there in the last year of his life. I think there's a lot going on with that, and you kind of nailed it.
Young musicians have those haunts. There's a couple of them for Justin. One is the Chicken Shack. I just love this idea that there were all these young musicians kind of gathering and listening to music together and learning songs and kind of establishing their identities. And those kinds of places, when young musicians can find them, are so important in their development.
So important. I got very excited by the moment I was made aware of this place called the Chicken Shack, which, for those who haven't read the book, is basically just a backyard kind of shed teenage hangout spot. The backyard of the Welch household, where the singer-songwriter Dustin Welch lived. And he kind of, Dustin moves out there as a, he's a his father is Kevin Welch, a Nashville musician as well, and Dustin moves out there as a teenager and kind of just makes it his teenage crash pad, and soon starts attracting basically an entire generation of roots musicians coming to this backyard hangout place. People from Old Crow Medicine Show, Jason Isbell, Malcolm Holcomb, of course, Justin Townes Earl, Carrie Ann Hurst from Shovels and Rope. All these musicians start hanging out back here, and they're listening to records, they're jamming, they're smoking weed and messing around, they're watching movies, and eventually they start writing songs and recording like profound, some of Justin's most early profound recordings that I hope the world hears one day, is were recorded back in that chicken shack. I was so excited about this place because on one hand it is so specific. It's this little, 10 by whatever little space that I think you can really trace Justin's artistic story from. And on the other hand, it's almost like every story of an artistic community, there's always a chicken shack, right? And also any teenager growing up in most parts of America can kind of relate to that place where you're kind of finding adolescent community. You can't really go to bars yet. All these guys are hanging out at the chicken shack when they've like in that 18 to 21 window. Yeah, I was just very moved. There's a real innocence to, I think, the kind of community that Justin found, socially and artistically in that space. Again, just miles or two away from where he grew up in Nashville, and in the Green Hills neighborhood of Nashville.
And we have the Edgewater, I believe it's Edgewater Supper Club is the official.
Springwater.
Springwater, excuse me. Yeah,
Yes.
Springwater Supper Club. And that's kind of the place where, again, this is something for young musicians, finding that venue that allows them to develop and where they kind of get their legs. And that seems like that's what that was for him.
Definitely. Justin and his teenage, first Justin by himself as a teenager, and then eventually with this band with Dustin Welch, the Swindlers, start kind of like honing all their skills and playing what by many accounts were pretty bad shows at the Springwater for many years. Very unrehearsed, very drunken shows, but at this place where you can kind of go on stage whenever you want, and when there are people from all sorts of different genres, there's noise punks and stand-up comedians and rappers and kind of avant musicians and loud rock bands, all these kind of like musicians experimenting and really kind of just fostering community. This is in the late 90s and early 2000s in Nashville. And there's a lot of darkness going on at a place like Springwater as well. There's a lot of mental health and heavy substance use, and there's also a lot of hijinks and just fun, crazy, crazy stuff happening alongside all that. And there's a lot of beautiful art being made. And in terms of, I think in terms of the two creative physical spaces in the city of Nashville that most, I think, are most central to understanding the formation of Justin as a songwriter and a performer, I think it would be first the Chicken Shack and right behind it the Springwater, which still the Springwater still stands today. And it was just blocks from the Springwater where Justin moved in the very last year of his life to an apartment, to your point earlier.
One of the things that impressed me most about Justin was, even it seemed like when he was really struggling with substance abuse, his work ethic was incredible, that he would just write, and he would kind of lock himself away and write. So it's like, surely the substance abuse has some, it's interfering someplace with the art, but he still had that determination to create.
Justin, really at any starting with the first, when he first starts writing songs as about a 15-year-old in the late 90s, up until really, I would say maybe the last year of his life, which is, I think, in my, from what I'd gathered, kind of the only time when his substance use got so bad that it really started to impede his ability to write and think clearly. But from that really 20 plus year period, Justin is writing constantly. He is Songwriting mattered so much to him. He took it so seriously. He viewed it as very integral to his identity. it was really a daily routine, a daily thing for him. He would get up, have his coffee. He would take out his iPad and, mess around on the watch news and watch little clips and stuff. And then he would go into wherever he was living. He would always have a room to write. And it was really revelatory looking through some of Justin's lyric, notebooks, because, Justin, of course, he was full of bravado, and he didn't emphasize the work that he put in when he talked about his songwriting. He would say, "Oh yeah, I write 10 songs a year. I write them on cocktail napkins, and I don't write more than what goes into an album." And yet, looking at the notebooks, for example, of a song like White Gardenias or Kids in the Street or Saint of Lost Causes, and Justin would have 30 drafts of these songs, more, and he would just meticulously write and rewrite and recraft and cross out. And he just, you could tell, it was so moving to me to get to see those notebooks, because it really showed me very viscerally. And, some of these notebooks still have his like tobacco stains and little stray tobacco in them that, he's rolling cigarettes and stuff the whole time. But it really showed to me in a visceral way just the utter amount of work and determination he put into songwriting at any stage of his career.
So he's doing the kinds of things that, when you go to school to study writing, they talk to you about revision and all of the craft stuff. And he was a guy who struggled with school. He didn't do well in school, but he's demonstrating all these abilities, and nobody's he's an autodidact.
Justin self-taught in so many ways, of course, as a songwriter, though, of course, he has his father, Steve Earle, as a bit of a, at least informal instructor there. But yeah, Justin did not have a high school education. He dropped out of school in early high school. He read voraciously. He could recite to you obscure Abraham Lincoln speeches from the 1830s. And I mean, like, not the Gettysburg Address, like obscure speeches he had memorized. He was an avid historian of baseball and of Negro League baseball and the Civil War. And he watched Ken Burns documentaries religiously. And he took his learning very seriously. It was, I think, a really important part of how he absorbed the world and the larger world around him. Of course, American music history, he was like, a scholar in so many ways. And yeah, I think he applied his discipline, though he was not cut out for school in any way. And really struggled in school as a child and as a teenager. He applied an enormous amount of discipline and rigor and, the seriousness with which he took his songwriting. I mean, people like Guy Clark were Justin's, mentors and heroes and folks associated with his father. And I think he hardly needed to go to school to understand, the tradition of just like taking the writing super seriously and applying all that work and rigor and just showing up to the desk every day kind of philosophy that someone like Guy had. I think Justin absorbed that wholeheartedly. And yeah, it's really beautiful to look at his journals and see that work at play.
I'm always cautious about attributing song lyrics and so forth and saying, okay, that's really the person. But of course, the semi-famous rant that he goes on in that YouTube video before White Gardenias about, what's causing you pain? Why don't we ask people that? And as I was listening to him do, talk that his way through that, it occurred to me, I'm like, it's in so many of his songs what's causing him pain, at least to me. I listen to like Moving On, and I hear this guy who's maybe got some guilt about the troubled nature of his parents' relationship or mama's eyes. And it's there.
Definitely. Justin, I think one of the things that I came to appreciate so much about his songwriting, truly through the process of spending every day for 3 years listening to him and writing this book, is that on one hand, Justin did have some songs that were so obviously him. A song like Mama's Eyes is very obviously and purely autobiographical, and also just like, its emotions and its autobiography are on the page right in front of you. And then there are all so many other songs in which Justin, I would say more commonly, Justin, he found these various ways to, through his craft and through that labor of songwriting, found ways to create a little bit of distance between the I and the narrator in the song and the characters in the song. And he did this in so many different ways that I've come to view as truly maybe central to his songwriting genius. You know, I think White Gardenias, the song you were referring to, is a great example. It's a song about Billie Holiday. You know, I'm doing air quotes now, right? Because in this time in Justin's life in his 30s, he found, I think, it a bit safer or a bit more real to him to sing about his own pain by singing about the pain of Billie Holiday's. On his last album, The Saint of Lost Causes, he starts writing these sort of more socially minded songs about characters that were very obviously not him. You know, someone who grew up in Los Angeles, or a Puerto Rican protagonist that's imprisoned in New York. And some of these songs are, I view, some of his most purely haunted, purely autobiographical songs. He's putting so much of, it's almost as if he's able to put even more of himself into these characters because they're not him. And earlier in his career, on his like real old school kind of throwback country records, I think he's often able to sing these very painful songs of abandonment and sort of loneliness, because they sound like 1950s, you know, honky tonk tunes that you can dance to, right? Like song like "What Do You Do When You're Lonesome," which is the title of my book, or "Ain't Glad I'm Leaving." These are, if you're just reading the lyrics, like these are haunted, profound statements of loneliness. But he's singing them. There's a lot of space there musically. Earlier in his career, he created the space with more music rather than narratively. So I just think he found all these ways to, he did not really want to be a songwriter who was purely viewed as that kind of bleed out on the page, Nick Drake sort of. What was so interesting to me is his biographer was coming across recordings from that predated his solo career that were some of the most autobiographical things he'd ever written that he never so much as released or shared with the world, because it was too much, you know, it was too vulnerable. And those were, of course, a goldmine for me because they showed so much.
You really put a spotlight on his guitar playing. And I was telling somebody recently, I was like, you know, the songs were so good and the singing was so good that I kind of forgot about the guitar playing. And then I go back and listen to him, like, oh, man.
The thing, too, about Justin's guitar playing is that you don't even, if you listen to the records only, there are a few songs, like They Killed John Henry on Midnight at the Movies, really shows just in right in front of you just his guitar picking style. But oftentimes you kind of had to see him live. And more than that, you kind of had to see him solo, or just acoustic, or, you know, the portion of the full band set where he just comes out and does two songs by himself. That was really where Justin's totally one-of-a-kind guitar picking and playing style shows off. And, you know, I hope that there's a live record that gets released one day that really can show fans who didn't get to see that. I'm not a musician. I was very intimidated intimidated by the task of trying to describe his really innovative guitar playing. I relied on a few musicians to really help me with that, including Dustin Welch, including Corey Brannan, the blues singer from Memphis, also really helped me. But Justin did what most people in any kind of folk or blues tradition in this country did. He took about six or seven or eight different influences. In this case, you know, Mance Lipscomb and Mississippi John Hurt, Malcolm Holcomb, his aunt Stacy Earle, a couple local musicians in Kentucky that he studied with. He took all these different all these different styles, and kind of made it his own with a type of drop thumb finger picking that usually had people, especially early in his career when no one knew who this guy was, there were oftentimes people that were suspicious that he was either playing to a backing track or had like a secret guitar player off stage adding guitar, because the sound that he created with one acoustic guitar, often cheap, crappy acoustic guitar, could sound like a full band. And it was just astounding to get to see.
Well, I'll close out on this. Sometimes I ask biographers, you know, what's the one thing you learned about the person you weren't expecting? But I actually ask you, like, what did you learn about yourself in this whole process of, you know, tracing this guy's life?
I think one thing that I learned when I went into this book process, I wanted to write a book about Justin because I was a huge fan of his, right? And on paper, Justin and I live very different lives. I feel like I have a very like close-knit family. I had a very sheltered childhood. I feel very fortunate to have not struggled with some of the really serious mental health and substance use struggles Justin has had. But, you know, I started writing this book and, you know, it really made me, for example, reflect on my own very close relationship with my dad, with whom I share, you know, passion for music over. And, you know, my dad taught me all my favorite musicians and songwriters and records. He showed them to me in high school, much in the way that Steve Earle showed Justin. And, you know, in some ways, it really did make, I mean, so it made me very, it really made me reflect in a powerful, profound, very grateful way for, you know, my family and my parents. I think they're in some ways more similarities than I could have, than I even realized at first. And, you know, halfway through the book, I was like, oh, I wonder why, I guess I'm sort of also in some way thinking and writing about me and my dad too, and writing about Justin and his father. So that was really kind of an interesting, you know, psychological experience for me. Yeah, I guess I'll go with that. I think, you know, this is my first book as a biographer, and I think Justin was so full of humanity in so many ways, and I think his story shows us so much about humanity and how beautiful it can be, how tragic and heartbreaking and just heart-wrenching it can be. And frankly, I think for me, getting to spend every day thinking about this stranger that I didn't know really made me reflect a lot about kind of how little there is that separates someone who lived a life like Justin in some ways that then someone who lived, you know, like I said, a pretty sheltered, stable, relatively stable life like my own. So it really, yeah, made me think a lot about, you know, how, sounds corny, but sort of how similar we all are in some ways.
You've been listening to a conversation with Jonathan Bernstein, author of What Do You Do When You're Lonesome? The Authorized Biography of Justin Townes Earle. You can learn more about Bernstein at johnbernsteinwriting.com. And What Do You Do When You're Lonesome is available now wherever books are sold. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.